materialist monism can be inclusive of and acknowledge qualitative experiences. Another way would be functionalism, which is probably, which is much more prevalent than Davidson's theory.
Mm-hmm. That's interesting. That's an
anomalous moment. Yeah.
Yeah. Just before we continue, I'd like to remind our listeners that you've been listening to the, or you are listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Brandon, and I've been speaking with Michael Robert Kaditz, and we've been discussing monism in the philosophy of mind. So to respond to Davidson's account, I think that's a viable way to go about solving some of the problems that I seem to be encountering with materialist monism, which is that mind and body are the same thing. It's just that when we speak in terms of body, we're giving one kind of description, and when we speak in terms of mind, we're giving another kind of description. So pain might be a particular configuration of physical states, but pain might also be an experience that takes a certain phenomenological structure, and that phenomenological structure and physiological structure have a one-to-one relationship. That is some kind of, you can phenomenologically break down fear as Heidegger has in Being and Time, but you can also physiologically break it down as having a certain kind of neurological structure. That was one of the replies that I was going to suggest, because let's go back to how that might be a problematic reply, because the reply that says, well, there's a problem here, would have to say something like, okay, you can say that they have a one-to-one relationship, but there's still something missing in just pointing to brain activity or neurological activity throughout the body and an experience. There might be some kind of correlation, but to say that the experience arises out of or is the same as a physiological as a physiological state, there's a problem there because something's still missing. Maybe some kind of interaction or something else. But, I mean, on this view, they would have to be, or there couldn't possibly be anything missing, because they kind of cover their own bases, or they cover each other's bases in a way. You point to pain in the body, and you say, I am pointing to your experience of pain. They share a one-to-one relation, unless I'm misunderstanding Davidson. But that seems to be what he's saying to me, that descriptions and states have a close relationship or a one-to-one relationship.
Yeah, functionalism, I think, could be described more as a many-to-one relationship, there's all alternate views then of that fall within the domain of materialism. So in a one-to-many relationship, there could be multiple events that serve certain functions, right, that fill the pain function or the happiness function or the sadness function. And that allows for neuroplasticity and allows for multiple realizability. So actually functionalism overcomes some of the limitations, some of the problems of the one-to-one type identity relationships, or even Donald Davidson's anomalous monism, which is a one-to-one, claim relationship between the body and the mind. But functionalism allows for multiple realizability of qualitative experiences. Those experiences can arise out of multiple physical brain states. But back to sort of the metaphysical issue here, like, I'm having trouble, Brandon, understanding what, if there's something missing that can't be described in the physical description or in a physical description, mm-hmm. in theory, right? Because we don't know everything about the biology of the human body. We don't know everything about the brain. So there's a lot science doesn't know yet. But if in theory we couldn't relate qualitative experiences to physical states in some way, whether they be identical or arise from, you know, whatever the relationship is, mm-hmm. if there's something more that would fall outside of the material realm, well, what is, first of all, what is it? What is it? And second of all, how does it reconcile with everything that we know about science, which is that the physical system is a closed system? So science tells us that the physical system is closed. Mm-hmm. Dualism contradicts that. Dualism suggests that there's something outside of the physical world. So you're going to run into this problem if you're not satisfied that qualitative experiences of the mind could ever be explained by biological events or biological states. Then you're going to have to confront this problem of, well, so you're alleging that there's some like supernatural world that exists out there. And I say supernatural because it's beyond the natural world of science as we know science to be. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, how do you justify that kind of claim? Is it you justify it through religion? Is it a faith-based, like just like a faith-based claim that there's like this supernatural world of souls? Is it that science is just got it wrong and there's a whole part of existence and the world out there that science fails to understand? And if that's your position, what's your evidence for that? So you're getting into challenging science and scientific inquiry and the scientific method and so on. If one claims that science has it wrong, what's your evidence for that? And if you say, I don't need evidence, then you're getting into this like world of superstition. So in my view, the consequences of denying that a materialist monist model accounts for everything, the consequences are, to me, mind-boggling, because you're venturing into a world of denial of science and of a kind of a structureless, boundless world where you can make any kind of claim you want and there's no reference point by which to discern truth from falsity.
I'm kind of glad that you brought up superstition and the supernatural in a way is in relation to materialist monism here, because I think the thing that really drives the persistence to try and keep talking about the philosophy of mind, despite having these monistic theories that are quite simple and just say, well, the mind and the body, they're the same thing. There's this insistence that, or there's this urge that keeps us to, it keeps us continuing to try to say more about the physical or our experiences. We could just, you know, wipe our hands and clean up the problems and say, okay, well, they're the same thing. But the conviction that there is more going on than this seems to be what powers this. And the thing that relating this to the supernatural and why I think it's interesting that you bring it up is that there is a kind of mysteriousness acknowledged to certain experiences that when I see something or experience something or have some profound feeling of the significance of an event or something like that, there's this conviction that that can't simply be explained by pure matter, or if it can, it's going to be a very strange materialist explanation. Like the configuration of material in the universe is going to look interesting. I don't know what its structure will look like, but it's continuously moved by, well, there has to be something more going on here. What I'm suggesting is there is a kind of operant dualism behind even people who ostensibly are willing to say that there is a monistic theory, or maybe, I don't know, maybe it's just a problem with the fact that people are continuously coming up with replies to monistic theories in terms of, you know, intentionality or something like that, that there's something more going on.
Well, I think most people aren't philosophers of mind, and most people don't concern themselves too much with metaphysical debates around the nature of the mind. I think what you're describing when you say that many people believe there's something more going on than just what can be described in physical terms, I think they're not really trying to resolve the intractable problems in the metaphysics of philosophy of mind. They're just noticing that there's a lot going on in their worlds, right? Yeah. And they can't understand a physical description of it or a physical explanation for it, and so they don't try. They know that there's, you know, their world is filled with so much non-physical stuff, you know. I mean, yeah. Politics, economics, in a way those things exist only in people's minds. There's so much that's so much of our world that does not seem to be, to a layperson, to someone not trying to dig into the metaphysics of it all, it seems to be in a different category than physical stuff that you can touch.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that's maybe what you're describing. That's maybe the sort of the underlying dualism in people's lay people's experience. And I get that. And then if you take a layperson who experiences the world as having a distinction between physical and mental things and try and nail them down, I think lay people that aren't into philosophy normally will just get frustrated and say, well, I don't know. To me, it seems like there's different kinds of things. So maybe that's what you're talking about in the dualism. But if you're studying philosophy of mind as an academic matter, then one might be called upon, as we are, to be more precise. And then just saying, well, it kind of seems to me like there's physical things and there's also mental things. And it kind of seems to me like I have a spirit, right? And so many people believe they have spirit. But it's a different project to talk about one's experience in life as a lay person who's just describing one's experience.
Hmm.
That's a different project than being a philosopher trying to study philosophy of mind and trying to really get to the truth of what the nature of the mind is. So in that latter case, well, let's put it this way. I think somebody could be in their everyday life sort of dualistic as you're describing,
mm-hmm.
but when they put on their philosopher's hat, if they put on a philosopher's hat, might say, well, yeah, I have all these qualitative experiences that seem to be non-physical, but my belief is academically, right, intellectually, my belief is that there's really no other way to explain those experiences than they arise in some way out of my biological physical brain state. And the brain is an amazingly complex thing. It's an amazingly complex work from which, you know, the possessor of that brain can have these qualitative experiences.
Here, I'm glad that you brought up kind of the distinction between a lay understanding of things and let's call it a philosophical understanding of things, where one is driven to try to explain things more clearly or articulately. And I think you're right. Not just that there is this distinction, there clearly is. There are people who are driven to try to explain these things, but it also explains the kind of story that I'm kind of painting here, that is the philosophy, the history of the philosophy of mind, that there has been an iterative process of trying to figure out what the mind is, and there is some desire or fundamental goal in this story, in this kind of developing field, to figure out what's going on. Now, not everyone has that urge, it seems. There really is a lay mind that doesn't seem to need to explain itself or doesn't have a desire to understand itself. So this is one of the other things that I wanted to touch on a little bit, which is, and I think that this is the perfect place to do it, is the place of Wittgenstein in this, because I think, well, Wittgenstein, I don't think he makes this distinction between a philosophical understanding and a lay understanding explicitly. From his later philosophy, that seems to be a distinction that at least conceptually he'll depend on. And his project is to take the reader or anyone who's engaging with his thought and to move them from a hyperactive philosophical position into a lay position where where certain problems that arise by virtue of the fact that we are thinking in certain ways about the philosophy of mind simply dissolve, because now we have moved back into a framework where the problems we have are no longer problems. Now, the problem that I have in the way that Wittgenstein is portrayed in this, in the field of the philosophy of mind, is that Wittgenstein is held up as a behaviorist, that he has a position that he takes, and that it is, as I was describing earlier, a kind of no-mind materialist, that really there is no mind at the end of the day, and all we have are behavior. Now, the reason I think that that misrepresents Wittgenstein is because if what he's trying to do is simply to solve problems by moving from the philosophical understanding of the mind to a lay understanding of the mind, and the consequence of that is that our philosophical urges are kind of attenuated, that doesn't necessarily mean that Wittgenstein is saying that there's nothing there. He's not trying to move the reader from a philosophical to a lay understanding, because he says, well, you're just wasting your time. There's nothing to be worried about here, so let's just move on. I don't think he denies that there are these experiences that we have, but I feel like he addressed them in a way that philosophers obviously would not have been amenable to, because a philosopher just is someone for whom this is a problem. But you can see, I hope you can see my point of representing Wittgenstein as having a sort of place in the philosophical history as a philosopher strictly, when really he was kind of trying to solve the problem in a non-philosophical way. But philosophers are going to pick that up in their understanding of their own need to explain the mind differently than how Wittgenstein might have intended that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I was also thinking as you were speaking that I'm not sure that I am convinced that the progression or the evolution of thought around the nature of the mind, that the evolution of the philosophy of the mind over the centuries has been like a bona fide linear progression of truth seeking.
Yeah.
And the reason I say that is because I think, as in other areas of philosophy and knowledge and truth seeking, there's been a lot of poisoning of the well by vested interests. And I'm thinking particularly of religious interests. An example I can think of is the way that it was so important to the Christian narrative for there to be a omniscient, omnipotent, all-powerful God that, and at the same time, it was important to the narrative for people to have free will. So a paradox arose, a problem arose for religious interests, right? For the theologians, for the church. The problem, of course, was if people have free will, it means that the future hasn't been determined. If the future hasn't been determined, then how could an omniscient God not know the future? So there, you know, there's various ways they try to, the medieval, you know, philosophers tried to explain that to varying degrees of success. Arguably, they fell short. So I guess what I'm saying is sometimes philosophers who have a vested interest, say, in their religion or in maintaining a certain, like I think Descartes and others, especially in Descartes' time, and even now, maybe we don't even realize what we do now to try and not cross certain lines. So we become marginalized or even, you know, thrown in jail or even, you know, executed like has happened to philosophers in the past. So I think that oftentimes our philosophy is not so objective, but it's tainted by vested interests or constraints that are put on us by the society around us. And so it's not just this linear progression of knowledge. It's takes a lot of detours, at the very least, right? It takes detours in response to constraints, society's pressures, vested interests. I think to some degree, those with an interest in promoting religion reverse engineer philosophy or reverse engineer things such that they develop a philosophy which seems to justify the religion. So they say, okay, they start with the premise, well, we need to prove the existence of a soul. We need to prove the existence of spirit. And so in order to do that, we need to now kind of reverse engineer the situation and say, well, how can we make an argument for the nature of the mind, which will then justify a claim that we have souls? So then we do that by saying, well, there's dualism. There's multiple substances, right? There's the physical substance of our brain, but there's also the non-physical or the immaterial substance, which constitutes our mind. And that is the domain of the soul and of spirit and of God. So it's, so I guess what I'm saying is I have some skepticism about the validity, of the, dualist claim in the sense that I question whether it's like a reverse engineered justification to achieve a predetermined, predesired outcome,
right?
Which is justification for belief in afterlife, soul, God, and all those things.
I'm thinking of Descartes' meditations where God has to come in to ensure that the thoughts that Descartes is having are not deceptions. Descartes needs God in order for the things to be perceived to be true, otherwise, because God is not a deceiver. If there's no God, then these things very well could be deceptions, but God wouldn't deceive me about that. So it's interesting that Descartes would sort of structure his metaphysics in such a way that God is a very necessary component for it to be an intelligible metaphysics that actually explains the apparent world. I'm also thinking, I think that's a good suggestion too, and I've been wary of this going into and explaining this. I've been referring to this story of the history of the philosophy of mind. I think it's obviously much more complicated than you get out of one class, but you need to start somewhere. You need to have a story, and then you need to, challenge the story and say, okay, well, this was kind of simplistic. You do need to have a story that contextualizes the theories and whatnot. But I do like your suggestion of, well, maybe there's kind of natural explanations for why this story goes the way it goes. You've been listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm Brandon Brownlee, and joining me is Michael Robert Kaditz. Bye for now.
philosophyshow.ca. You can find the Canadian Philosophy Show at tcps.podbean.com and on Apple Podcasts and Spotify.
I was born in a body with more than one soul. Two spirit together.
You're listening to CGSF 90.1 in